life.
A podcast of the cinema. You're Dave White, film critic for The Wrap and other places, and I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
Currently no other places.
Well, in your life, though.
Oh, in my life, lots of places.
Yes. And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor for The Wrap and film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I would call you a TV critic at The Wrap.
It's sweet if you just, no, not at The Wrap.
I would call you a TV critic at the What the Flick.
Well, agree to disagree. We've had this discussion. Speaking of television.
We're going to keep having it until you relent.
No, that's not true. Speaking of television, we also do a podcast called LKTV that is normally available only to our subscribers on our Patreon page, the people who've joined our club.
Hey, here you are, some of you.
Yes, but this week.
Hang on.
Was International Podcast Day. And
right.
So we made this week's episode of LKTV free for everybody.
Yeah.
So if you go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, not only can you join our club, but you get a free episode and find out what you've been missing.
Well, they could go back and listen to the earlier LKTVs that were free.
Yes.
Like the first 3 or 4 months or 5 months or however long we did it.
Yeah, there's about a dozen or so on iTunes that were free.
And then we pulled the rug out from under all y'all's.
Well, we kept telling you all along that it was
A's.
You know, first taste was free and then we could pay for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we did warn people.
Yeah.
But we snatched it out of your hand like an ice cream cone you weren't done with. And then we shoved it into the mouth of someone who was paying.
We hid it behind a paywall.
Yeah. We're tricky.
Where's your ice cream now?
But so many of you have subscribed. You've joined our club.
Yes.
Last week I read some names.
Would you like to read some more?
I'm going to read some more. I think I finished last week with the person who calls himself the letter Z.
Mm-hmm,
am
yes,
I right about that?
You did mention Z.
And I think, I can't remember who after that I read. So I'm just going to start from there. And if I'm going to read some names of thank you to you people, you wonderful people who give us money. Eric Yonner and... Oh, wait, you know what? Rail Gautier? I butchered that name last week, too. Sorry. Sean Gregory, Ryan McLean, Tom Kaiser, Kate McKeon, Jason Barnett. Oh, here's another name I can't pronounce.
White as in white bread.
Caoimhe. You pronounce that name.
We very much appreciate...
You go to the Gaelic part of the world and pronounce that name.
We so appreciate your patronage, even if we cannot pronounce your name.
Second name, Amber. Last name, Clancy.
All right.
I got those two proper.
Okay.
Thank you. And then Robert, who just has no last name.
Because he's a man of mystery.
Oh, wait. Robert Grant. Oh, and Bianca... Asner.
Oh, yay, Bianca.
One of our favorite publicists in the world.
Mm-hmm.
She's very nice to us.
And she's obsessed with your tea practice for some reason.
Well, why shouldn't she be?
It's a big world out there.
What I do with tea is impeccable.
Uh-huh.
Each day, I have a whole tea shelf. With a variety of teas.
Mm-hmm.
And not these blueberry ones. You know what I mean? Like, and I say blueberry because I know who's listening who has the blueberry tea. Pilar. And
you're like that character in Go Fish, where it's a joke that she has a million teas in her kitchen.
Yeah, but I have really good teas. Mm-hmm. I don't have, like, you know, like I just said, the blueberry kind.
And they're not too, like, ascetic either. They're not all twig and mud based.
No. These are good, strong black teas mm-hmm. from a variety of fancy purveyors.
Yes. Because you're a fancy man.
It's just a fact that I am.
Here's the thing.
I'm a fancy man.
Here's the thing I'm noticing now that October has begun.
Thanks, club members.
Yes. Thank you all. Thank you.
I was just reading the My People version of the... Like, you expensive-minded people on the other end of the spectrum?
Well, you should read some of them, too, at some
point. Oh, they're going to get their turn.
Okay.
All right. I'm giving the thanks to the to the gutter people.
They're all valuable at every level. We love you all. Shut up, Dave White.
On LKTV, I referred to all y'all as the gutter people because that's me. I know I just said I was a fancy man, but only with tea. Like, I'm kind of uppity when it comes to tea, but otherwise.
You're super frugal with everything else.
Otherwise, you're not getting a dime out of me.
Anyway, it's October, which is crazy because it's still hot in Los Angeles. So we're now officially in the final quarter, which means we're barreling into, like, you know, middle brow award season and all
that.
And
yesterday was our anniversary. Congratulations to us.
Hooray.
Are you new to this show? Then you just found out that we have an anniversary.
That's right. And not of the program. Well, that too. That's coming up.
That's coming up in what?
November.
December? November?
Yeah.
When did the Nutcracker in 3D open? Because that's my earliest memory.
It was November of 2010. That was like on our second or third episode. Okay. We reviewed that thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I've been trying to say about October, if you would stop interrupting me.
I won't.
You know, when December rolls around and I am in my element of the Christmas things, and I have to hear people complain about, oh, they're tired of hearing Christmas music at the mall, they're tired of the Christmas specials and the movies on TV, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I say nothing.
Right.
I say nothing. And the reason...
You restrain yourself.
And the reason that I say nothing...
From having a fight with somebody.
Uh-huh. Is because I also say nothing in October... When all my Facebook feed and all of Twitter is, oh my God, Halloween, Halloween, horror movies, horror movies, horror movies, Halloween, Halloween, horror movies, horror movies, horror movies.
But that's a thing too.
It is a thing.
It's a great thing.
It's not my thing.
You and me, we're going to sit down and watch Night Train to Terror.
But I shut up about it and let other people enjoy themselves because I want other people to shut up and let me enjoy December. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Would you be of a mind to harsh on Halloween people and their Halloween practices?
Look, if they dig it, that's great. But I'm just saying, it's not my jam, but I'm perfectly happy to let other people enjoy Halloween. Let me enjoy Christmas.
Here's the thing. I know why this happens. Halloween, still, after all these years and after the idea of, you know... After the idea of Halloween being anything resembling a night of chaos or terror or
spirits,
rebellion has been
tamped down,
completely evaporated from the culture to where all we have left are, you know,
sexy nurse costumes,
sexy hashtag, you know, like that's Halloween.
Right.
So much so that if I carve a pumpkin, then I feel like I've done my part.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, my costume every year is exactly the same. Fat man on the couch in his boxer shorts eating a bowl of candy.
Exactly.
Oh, wait. Sorry. Not generic candy. Specifically, all the Reese's Pieces that were ever made. I'm sorry. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, not Reese's Pieces.
Yes, I was going to say, what?
All the Reese's Peanut Butter Cups that I can shove into my face.
Now, do you have a preference between standard issue peanut butter cups and the smaller foil-wrapped individual peanut butter cups? Because I know some people have a thing about their chocolate to peanut butter ratio, and it changes from size to size.
The tiny foil-wrapped Halloween-sized Reese's peanut butter cups are a nice ratio of peanut butter inside stuff to chocolate outside stuff.
Okay.
However, having also lived my entire life eating the normal-sized...
The standard, yes.
Reese's cups, I can say that those are equally great to me in terms of peanut butter to chocolate ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I don't like.
The big cup?
I don't like the big cup. I don't like the dark chocolate cup. I don't like the Easter egg-shaped cup. I don't like the Christmas tree-shaped cup because then there's so much peanut butter and not very much chocolate.
Really?
That you're not getting...
I thought you were going to say the opposite. I think some people don't like the big cup because they think it's got too much chocolate.
No.
All right. I'm fine with the big cup. I am also with you, however, on the dark chocolate cup, even though, generally speaking...
You're a dark chocolate guy.
I'm a dark chocolate guy, but not with the peanut butter cups.
No, you need the milk chocolate. You need it to be exactly what it is.
Yeah. It's an oil-to-oil thing. I don't know what it
right.
is exactly.
You're absolutely right.
So basically what I'm saying is enjoy your Halloween, people. I'm not going to take anything away from you, but just get off my back when it's Christmas time, because then it's my time to shine.
But you're not going to... Here's the thing. You're not going to get people to get off your back at Christmas, because what you still have in the world during surrounding the discourse mm-hmm. over Halloween and Christmas... The way people talk about Halloween is as if it still were, in fact, the renegade's favorite holiday.
Uh-huh, right.
You know,
yes.
Because you know how gay dudes are like, that's gay Christmas. Well, no.
No.
Christmas is the gay Christmas,
right.
frankly.
If you're doing it right.
And the, you're not cool because you like Halloween and don't like Christmas. Also,
you're not dark.
Also, yeah, you're not edgy. Also, you're not a better, warmer human being for liking Christmas over Halloween.
Correct.
It's just what you like.
Yeah.
It turns out that what I like are things that allow me to have cocoa and peppermint together mm-hmm. in one sitting. Gingerbread and cookies and the cranberry cake thing I made. Last year.
Yes.
Yeah. The
suckling pigs and roast beasts.
Yeah, stuff like that. That's, I mean, we don't have three giant containers of Christmas tree ornaments for no reason.
Exactly.
So
I like a piney candle.
Our jam is the Christmas.
I like
and
our
other people's jam is Halloween.
Yes.
And we can all get along.
That's all I'm asking.
Yeah.
Because
did someone hurt you yesterday?
No, it's just that, I don't care.
Did someone insult your feelings about Christmas yesterday?
No. It's just that I've been bombarded of late with all the...
Everyone's already complaining about there being Christmas stuff in the stores.
A little bit of that. But
yeah.
No, really what it is that I've
it
been...
It is October 2nd. It's time.
Totally. No, I've already been bombarded with like all these, the horror marathons of this month and what TCM is showing and what's at the New Beverly and what's at the...
That's great. I can't wait for
which
all
is
stuff.
Great. And if you like horror movies, great. Dig in with both hands. Have at it.
Speaking of that...
But I'm just saying, when I'm then, you know, like obsessively cataloging like what's coming on TCM in December for Christmas, or when I'm, you know, listening to my Spotify Christmas, you know, music mix, or I'm whatever Christmasing, I don't want to hear the eye rolling from the people who talk about how they're just so sick of Christmas.
Can you hear eye rolling from people?
Oh, it scrapes.
Are people really like...
They're not coming at me.
Are people really atting you, are you setting up a straw man?
They're not coming at me, but I'm just saying, in their general, the same people who are proclaiming to the world...
I don't see you getting into too many fights about this.
No, you're not. It's not that they're coming at me.
Right.
But I'm saying the same people who would be likely to proclaim on their Facebook page, oh, wow, they're showing all of the Christopher Lee Mummy movies this weekend on TCM. Hooray,
yes.
Hooray.
Yeah.
Are then going to be the same ones in 2 months are like, ugh, I can't go shopping without hearing Jingle Bell Rock 10,000 times.
Well,
like,
you can't go shopping without hearing Jingle Bell Rock 10,000 times.
Too bad.
And it is irritating.
You had October. You got to dominate the pop
culture. But there aren't Halloween
songs. Well, there's the Monster Mash. You got to dominate. You got
okay,
to.
There's a Halloween song.
You got, what and, I'm, well, there are pumpkin carols. Lioness goes singing them. I don't know what they are.
The Shags have a Halloween song. I know that.
There's This Is Halloween from Nightmare Before Christmas. There are Halloween songs.
All right, fine.
And I understand. You can go shopping without hearing This Is Halloween Town at the mall. I'm just saying. This month is all pumpkin spice flavored. And so, fine, let me have my chocolate peppermint flavored December and be even about it.
I feel like you're overreacting to something that hasn't even happened yet.
I'm just judging
from... Are you preemptively arguing with people? Is that what's happening?
I'm not arguing.
You are.
I'm not arguing with anybody. I'm just saying my experience from years past has been when I'm trying to enjoy my December,
okay.
I'm surrounded by Grinches.
All
and
right,
whereas
great.
I am Grinches. Spending October being a real chill bro.
You sure are being a real chill bro right now.
Everybody loves Halloween.
You're being real chill right now about this.
It's us. We can have this conversation.
I have to tell you something.
I'm not throwing it out into the...
I have something to explain to you right now.
I'm not going after people on Twitter.
I have something to explain to you right now.
What's that do? What?
This conversation is not just with us at the moment. You plugged in all the cords. We're speaking into microphones. I mean, I know we would be having this conversation even without the microphones, which is the whole reason we're doing this podcast.
Yes.
Almost 6 years later. But people are hearing what we say.
I'm just saying.
They can hear us.
I'm not mad at anybody. And I'm not precluding anybody from
We're done talking about it.
Thorough enjoyment of Halloween.
It sure was a great conversation.
I just want reciprocation in December.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
I've shared.
Yes.
We can press on.
Speaking of Halloween and horror things.
Yes.
I'm just going to do my DVD pick right now.
Okay.
The Wailing. It comes out Tuesday.
I need to see it.
Tuesday, October 4th. The coolest effing weird horror occult religious I can't even explain film as evil spirit incantation. That's what this is. South Korean movie called The Wailing. I've talked about it when it was released earlier this year. It's one of my favorite films of the year. Not just one of my favorite horror films.
Right.
Of the year. It's one of my favorite films of the year. It's 2.5 hours long. I guarantee you it's the weirdest thing you've seen this year that isn't a documentary called Tickled.
And also, speaking of long-ass movies, we're going to talk about Andrea Arnold's American Honey next week.
Because I haven't seen it yet.
Because Dave hasn't seen it yet. And I suspect that you're going to totally disagree with me about it, and we'll have a healthy chew-over on it, because if you go see my review on What the Flick this week, neither Matt Atchley nor I were big fans. But you have seen...
Well, it was just you and Matt.
We were the only ones who'd seen it. But
maybe I'll go see it with Christy and she and I can have a throwdown.
There you go.
You don't know what we're going to do.
I don't know if she'd like it or not, but I suspect you might, because you're more familiar with the oeuvre of Andrea Arnold.
Is that how you say that word?
Oeuvre, yeah.
It's not...
It's not oeuvre.
Here's the thing. I studiously avoid saying that word out loud because I've never heard anyone pronounce it the same way twice. And the people who do pronounce it that I know are smart sound wrong when they say it. And so I've written it and I will continue to write it.
You are more familiar with the filmography of Andrea Arnold than I am.
I'm a big fan.
Yes. So I'll be really interested to hear your takeaway. And
Red Road, Fish Tank. Wuthering Heights.
And maybe you can talk me off the ledge on this one and explain to me why it's actually good, but woo! Anyway, we'll talk about that next week. But what we're talking about this week is Tim Burton's latest Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Sorry. Which I did not care for, and you apparently...
I kind of cared for it.
All right.
Yeah.
Explain what it's about.
Well, there's a kid. This is a Tim Burton. Did we say Tim Burton?
I said Tim Burton, yeah.
Asa Butterfield is a teenage boy.
I think it's Asa.
Is it Asa?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of Asa from Shaws of Sunset.
Yeah, no, it's not like that. There was an Asa on One Life to Live, I think. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it's Asa.
The A-S-A spelled name person that I like the best is on Shaws of Sunset. Mm-hmm. So until that kid comes to me and tells me different.
But that is a lady and this is a gentleman. It's the kid who was in Hugo and Ender's Game.
All right. Asa Butterfield plays this teenage kid who lives in Florida, Tim Burton's favorite land of relentless suburban sunshine. And is he from there? No, he's from here. He grew up in Burbank.
He doesn't even really Florida up Florida as much as I would have expected in a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, I know.
Like there could be a Larry Clark movie for all the...
And he has some... Do we call them mental health challenges?
Ace Butterfield?
The character.
No, I don't think so.
He has to go see a psychiatrist.
No. That's after his grandfather dies. He has to see a grief therapist.
Yeah.
Because his grandfather, played by Terrence Stamp, dies under mysterious circumstances that involve...
However, even before the death of his grandfather, he has sort of a prickly relationship with his father, which is a typical Tim Burton kind of thing.
Yes. Played by Chris O'Dowd in a weird American accent.
A very weird American accent.
Asa Butterfield, also not American, but is a better accent.
Is he not?
He's like British or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it's stiff in this movie, I think, but we'll get to that.
So he goes to the therapist. Sorry, we had to stop for a second. The wind blew a door closed, and then my headphones crapped out on me. They're battery-operated, noise-canceling headphones. And I go through batteries like I change socks.
I don't know what that's about. My batteries last longer in mine.
Well, you know, I'm an audiophile.
You're deaf. You're not an audiophile. If anything, that's why they're crapping out. You got to turn up the volume because your old man punk ears are
I listen to a lot of beautiful music on the headphones.
Uh-huh.
And I use the headphones a lot.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so he goes to the therapist. And
you're skipping everything.
I'm not going to. Okay, did you do it then?
God.
I was going to get to it, but you're very impatient.
You're doing it wrong.
Okay, go. Do it right.
All right, Terrence Stamp is a grandfather. And Terrence Stamp, over the course of this kid's life, very close to the grandfather, much closer to him than to his own father. And Terrence Stamp talks about having been a refugee from Poland, right before World War II started. He was sent to live in this home for peculiar children. And he shows him the pictures of the other kids who live there. And it's like, there's an invisible boy, and there's a girl who has to wear lead shoes because she floats away. And there's whatever. They're like the
kids made of gauze.
Yeah, exactly. These odd little sort of Edward Gorey X-Men, basically. So then the grandfather dies, weird circumstances, there's some giant monstrous thing in the shadows that clearly killed him.
Yeah.
Parents send him to see a grief therapist played by Allison Janney. The mother, by the way, played by my lady, Kim Dickens, who has three lines.
Well, she has like two scenes or something.
In one of them.
No,
it's ridiculous.
I know.
Anyway. So grief therapist says, you know what, you should go back and see the home. So he goes with the father, with Chris O'Dowd, who is some sort of author about ornithology or something. They're never very clear about this.
Yeah.
And, so he goes to the home. It is, of course, destroyed because it was bombed by the Germans in the 40s. But then as he's looping around, as he's snooping around the property, he runs into the kids from the photos.
Yeah.
What? And it turns out that Miss Peregrine, who is played by Eva Green, is a...
Who I love.
She's...
I love her.
Yeah. This is not one of her better films, but she's always good.
I love her.
She's a... I forget what the term they make up for her is, but it's these people who can turn into birds and manage time. And she...
It's like an empyrean or...
An empyrean or something.
Something.
Yeah, starts
something
with
like
a
that.
Y.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... She basically has magically created a time loop in which the house exists in the 24 hours prior to the German bomb destroying it.
And they have to live the same day.
Over and over.
And they've done that since September, whatever day it was.
3rd, 1943. And the movie never explores that much in terms of the idea of, like, you'd think they would have gone mad by now from the repetition. But no, apparently not.
They don't age.
They don't age.
In this process.
And it's like they're in Shangri-La. If they step outside, they'll turn to dust. And so then the kid is like, he's not sure if he should stay or not. And then there's these evil.
There's
evil
peculiars
with no eyes.
There are bad peculiars with no eyes, and they're called the Hollows.
Right. Led by, as Matt described, Samuel L. Jackson, led by zombie Frederick Douglass. Who want into the loop for some reason, or they want to steal the loop, or they want to steal the inbreeds or something, and
they have
something, something, something.
Well, here's what I gathered from the presence of the Hollows is that they want that kind of immortality. They want that eternal life.
I see.
And so, and somehow or other, the Eva Green and the kids have to be destroyed for this to happen. It's a little convoluted.
As Bibbs likes to say, because reasons.
Right. But here's... Well, you say what you don't like, and then I'll say what I like.
No, I didn't care about the characters. They're really not fleshed out much beyond this girl sets things on fire, and, this girl's really strong, and this one makes plants grow, This
kid's full of bees.
Yeah, this kid is literally full of bees. So much of the movie is spent explaining things, or very pointedly not explaining things, so they can be mentioned, so they can be explained later in Act 3 when they're going to be a reveal or whatever. I just was not interested, and I didn't get the stakes of it at all. Judi Dench plays a character who is completely extraneous. Like, you could literally just cut her out of the movie and no one would notice. It would make no difference to the plot whatsoever. I just was not amused. And it, for a movie that should be sort of like, you know, just the title alone implies that it's going to be sort of creepy and eccentric, but amusing and witty at the same time. And it's just, I didn't care. The art direction is impeccable. And the costumes and all that stuff, but the plotting is tedious, and I was never engaged in the story or the people in it.
We have reached the stage in Tim Burton's filmmaking life where that initial wave of delight has come and gone.
Well, he had a pretty good streak there for a while.
I know. I understand. But that feeling that you had for him in the 80s and early 90s of, this guy's on our team. This guy gets us, the weird people of the world.
Okay.
And for me, that feeling is largely gone. Mostly because I have not enjoyed a film from him in quite a while.
Frankenweenie, I think.
Yeah.
Frankenweenie and Sweeney Todd are the only recent ones. Because I just had to do this, me and everybody else apparently, just did their rankings of his filmographies for the internet. I did mine on the Wrap. And
his
oeuvre. Those two were the only ones for me recently that popped up. And so it was like, you know, the top of the list is Beetlejuice and Pee Wee and Ed Wood and you know, Batman Returns. And then down at the bottom is Alice in Wonderland and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Planet of the Apes and all the recent cruddy stuff.
I still respond to his visual sense. Even in something that I despised, like Dark Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I like the look. I like the look of everything, even if I hate the film.
You like the coffee table book version of it, if nothing else. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I like the LACMA exhibit of Tim Burton's career.
Not that we went.
Oh, I went.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't go. I missed it. Okay.
And
did you go to the Del Toro?
That's still up right now, I think.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. Where was I?
You like the look.
I like the look. But I cannot say that his sensibility has aged well for me personally. I think that he is a little stuck. And unlike people who continually explore similar themes and return to themes in their films again and again, with him, often I feel like he's borrowing from himself without expanding himself.
Yeah.
But I didn't hate this. Because not only do I think it looks really cool,
mm-hmm.
not only do I like all the kids, I like the casting of the kids. I think every one of those kids has kind of a funny face. And I don't mean that they're ugly. I mean that they have distinctive, memorable faces. And that is kind of 80% of all their characters. You know, their peculiarity.
Their visual representation.
And their look. But
it shouldn't have been 80%.
I mean, know you think that Asa Butterfield's performance was stiff, but I felt like it was appropriately earnest. I believe that his performance in Ender's Game was better because it was it was very worried. And, well, and this time around,
he's
I
the
don't,
straight man, obviously. Yeah, yeah. But I think there's a way to do that and still... You can still bring a little something to the table and allow yourself to be outshined by, outshone by the more colorful people around you. And I just, to me, here he reads like a big cipher.
I will give you that. I think I was mostly simply happy that Tim Burton wasn't trying to give me comedy. This is not a comedy.
Right.
It is an adventure. It's sort of a race against time, literally, because it's about people who are stuck in a time loop and trying to break out of it, or not trying to break out of it, or defending themselves from people who are trying to break into it.
Right.
And it's a more heartfelt film than what I have seen from him lately, from in films like Alice in Wonderland and Dark Shadows and I'm blanking on whatever else has come recently. I believe it's Eva Green that says close to the end of the film, and I believe this is the point of the movie. You cannot fix the world to make it safe for yourself. So someone is going to die. And an orphanage is going to get bombed by the Nazis. And terrible things are going to come along. So you can't make the world safe. You can only make yourself brave. I think the film communicated that. And I enjoyed watching it. I was not bored. I like the visual invention, although I've seen some of this stuff from him before.
Yes.
So
to the point where
something
almost felt like specific shout-outs to specific things.
I know that Bibbs wrote a review that talked about...
Oh, it was about the refugee crisis?
About the refugee crisis.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Bibbs. I don't know what that means.
I don't see that. And I have not read his review. I just read the headline. And I was looking for that, but I don't see it.
No.
I'm going to go read his review to see what he's talking about. This is not top tier Tim Burton. It's also not bottom of the barrel Tim Burton.
It's top of the bottom for me.
If you like him in general, but you are often disappointed by his work, you may enjoy this. Because I sort of did. With reservations.
Yeah, it seemed to me, and again, you'd think I would have learned by now, just because something sounds like it would be right in his wheelhouse doesn't mean it's going to be. I think like Tim Burton at his best could have turned this into something right, or maybe with a better screenwriter attached. This is the woman who wrote Kingsman: The Secret Service.
Yeah.
To me, it didn't work. I didn't respond to it in a dramatic way, in a narrative way. The characters meant nothing to me. It was neat to look at, but that wasn't enough to sustain it. I would argue an attempt to do something different of late was Big Eyes. Yeah, I mean, it was reteaming with the Ed Wood writers, but at least visually he wasn't doing his nutty little levels of filigree. It was really more about being kind of period specific and absurd within that context. But that was a movie that just didn't work for a lot of other reasons.
Are we done with this?
Are you going to respond to what I just said, or were you even listening?
I was listening, okay. But I can't disagree with you, okay. Because I know you have, you know.
No, but I'm not even talking about Peregrine. I'm going back to what you said before about how he does the same thing over and over again. I'm arguing that Big Eyes was at least an attempt to not do the same thing, but it was still not a good movie.
Not great. Yeah.
That's another one. On Bibbs' list, he had it very high, and he and Ingo were talking on Facebook. I don't know why more people don't like Big Eyes. I'm like, because it's not good. That's why.
Because we told you.
Because you're wrong. Anyway.
You saw a documentary that I have not seen, and I saw one of the wide-release films that you have not seen.
Yes. This is a movie that I was rather surprised to learn that it was opening in Los Angeles this weekend. It kind of came out of nowhere. So I don't know how much it's going to get around, but I imagine it'll be on DVD soon. It is a documentary called Seed Money, about a guy named Chuck Holmes, who was an early home video entrepreneur, let's say. He founded a company called Falcon Studios. And if you don't immediately know what that is.
Falcon Video Pack number 4.
Falcon was a very, very popular
gay... too late. They'd gotten too hot.
Gay porn studio based in San Francisco. And it really played a key role in creating a gay archetype.
Bob was cruising his favorite public restroom at lunch.
Dave is quoting old trailers. When he sees Super Stud Al Parker. The movies created, I think, a very specific aesthetic archetype for gay men of the 1970s.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there was a Falcon Studios look.
Yeah, there was. Know,
and it was like...
You've always called it the Falcon Car Wash.
Right, yeah. I didn't make that up. But, oh, yeah.
You didn't?
I did not, no. Oh. But yeah, so basically it was
to
like...
To me, you made it up.
Well, no, sadly, I cannot take credit for it. But so it was like smooth, muscular, often but not always blonde... there was a very Southern California beachy vibe.
I'm getting some water while you're talking about.
Sometimes a Northern California Bay vibe, but you know, nonetheless, it was always very outdoorsy. It was very macho. And you know, super, super popular. And you know, throughout the 70s and 80s, like one of the dominant forces in the industry. But of course, over that time, obviously, the AIDS epidemic reared its ugly head. And Holmes, at that point, after having been, you know, somewhat of a shady character, as a lot of people in the industry can be, the ones who are making money at it, was really going out of his way to try and become more of a philanthropist. And so he would give money to politicians. He would give money to AIDS organizations. And the documentary sort of explores how a lot of those people either... didn't want to take his money at all, or
really?
if they took it, they wanted to downplay his association to it.
Everyone's a jerk.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But there is, however, there's an LGBT youth center, I think, in San Francisco that is named for him because he was a substantial donor.
Right on.
So you know, he did get his credit in some corners, and frankly, you know, for all the sort of you know, the people can be about pornography, and gays can be that way about pornography too. They're all watching it. They all like it.
Right.
And you know, somebody made that guy rich. You know, they might all try and pretend that they had nothing to do with it.
Oh, not me.
Somebody was buying those video packs. Anyway, it's a really...
I've actually never bought a single thing in my whole life.
Well, yeah, nowadays no one does. That's why, you know...
No, I mean, even back in the day.
No, I know.
Like, even back in the day when there was an... like, when I was out of college and I had my first job and I had a teensy tiny bit of disposable income, there was never a moment where I thought, I'm going to buy this porn VHS.
But you rented...
No.
Really?
Not really.
Oh, man. I rented like crazy. Anyway, it's an interesting documentary. They talk to a lot of the people who are still around. Holmes passed away, but there's a lot of great footage of him. Mike Stabile directed it. My friend Brian Darling edited it. It's an interesting documentary, and it's a corner of gay cultural history that has not been explored nearly enough, I don't think, in a non-prurient way. But I think is very essential to sort of understanding where the community is now and you know, how we got here.
The reason I didn't buy anything or even rent much... That car wash did not produce my kind of dude.
Well, but
never.
But
really.
there were other labels with other.
I never
aesthetics.
Saw. I never knew them. I never saw them. I never knew they existed.
Okay.
It's
true though. In the late 80s, early 90s, it was kind of inescapable.
There was one
kind of dude in porn.
It was in fact. Gay porn was in fact one of the reasons why. It took me a little longer to come out.
Oh, interesting.
Because I didn't understand, A, that I could look like me and be gay, and B, that I could like other dudes that kind of were in my ballpark of body shape and type.
Interesting.
And be gay. There was, and furthermore, that I was allowed to desire that.
Right.
That if I looked at, let's say... a chunky man who ran a film festival in Dallas, Texas, and said to myself, he's real cute.
I wasn't that chunky then.
Yeah, you were.
Relatively, no. I'm way chunkier now.
That's because I've been feeding you for 21 years.
Mm-hmm. Enabler.
Yeah. No,
you're right, though.
There was a consensus.
Right.
In gay culture about what was beautiful. What was sexually viable.
Yeah.
And I knew after, you know, about 6 months of actually coming out, mm-hmm. I knew it was wrong. I knew they were wrong. Because I was like, you know what? I've been out for 6 months and things are pretty good, if you know what I mean.
No, there's a language of desire that the media sort of perpetuates.
And I'm not seeing it reflected anywhere out there. Like, either I'm completely crazy and lucky.
Right.
Or everyone's wrong about what's out there to be enjoyed and who will enjoy you in return.
There were little corners of difference out there, you know, like the cult guys, obviously, were all super hairy, okay, you know, yeah. and then there was like, you know, bulk mail and some of those early publications.
Do you know
were
where I learned? Here's where I learned about bulk mail magazine. David Sedaris. Because he wrote about his favorite weird porn magazines one time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Straight and gay. But one of the titles was Bulk Mail, and I was like, what is that? And then I went to a newsstand and actually found a copy of Bulk Mail, and I was thinking, and when I found it, I thought, yeah, I'm not into this either. And so, you know, I was in that middle, you know.
What we're saying is, you kids with the internet, where you can just Google every dang thing possible.
And you think that he's like, oh, I like this and this and this. And then there's a whole website for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least a Tumblr.
To paraphrase an old designing women joke, left-handed girls who eat chicken who think Oswald acted alone.
So anyway, is this on DVD or so? Not yet. Theatrical
right now it's theatrical.
Is it streaming?
I don't believe it is yet, but like I said, I'm sure it'll be available soon.
Who's distributing it, do you know?
I think Breaking Glass, so I think they'll have the DVD of it.
Okay.
And then you saw...
I'm interested in seeing this
No,
film.
I think you would find it interesting. Yeah. You saw Masterminds.
Yes.
Because I, after enduring Gentleman Broncos and Austin Land, was like, I'm not seeing any movies directed by someone named Hess.
Oh, because his wife directed Austin Land?
Yeah.
Jared Hess.
Yeah.
Who directed Gentleman Broncos and Nacho Libre.
And Napoleon Dynamite.
This is a true story. And it's, I got to say that even though it says at the beginning of the movie, based on a true story, which is code for none of this happened.
Right. The Coens ruined that for everybody.
Most of this happened.
Oh, funny.
This is really weird. The things that you think are too silly to have happened.
Huh.
Yeah. In 1997, and it is a period film set in 1997, a man named David Gant in Charlotte, North Carolina, who worked for the Loomis Fargo Armored Car Service, he robbed it. And he got famous for doing it because he stole more money than pretty much anybody in American history. He robbed them for $17 million.
Wow.
Most of it wrapped in bundles of 20. And he did so to impress a lady that he worked with. She had recently quit. And her friend, a guy named Steve Chambers, and the woman's name was Kelly Campbell. In the film, David Gant is played by Zach Galifianakis. Kelly Campbell is played by Kristen Wiig. Her friend Steve Chambers, in the film, played by Owen Wilson, he is the organizer of this heist. He sets up David Gant. He sets up Galifianakis to do the robbery and take the fall. And then he sends Galifianakis off to Mexico with the story, you go down there until the heat's off. And then we'll wire you down your millions.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll get you come back up here for your millions. No. So what happens is in the movie version, Galifianakis robs the bank. They put $20,000 into his underwear and he goes to Mexico. In real life, I think it was $50,000. But he quickly burned through it. doing all kinds of, you know, I'm in a 5-star hotel, you know. All
right.
Meanwhile, the plan was for the people back home to lay low themselves and not go on wild spending sprees.
Is this like that moment in Goodfellas where all the women show up in furs?
Yeah.
After the Lufthansa heist?
Yeah. They all go on wild spending sprees. And they don't just go on wild spending sprees. They go on entirely class-changing spending sprees. So they all are from trailer parks, which is why this heist was known in the press as the Hillbilly Heist. Inexperienced amateur criminals who hadn't ever done anything like this before, and who then made a series of increasingly dumb mistakes. Like moving out of a trailer park into a $5 million mansion. You know?
Who's going to notice?
Yeah. So they all get busted.
Is it just, now we say they all, is just the three of them, or?
Well, three and some other folks involved. Yeah. They all get busted, the end. But what's funny about the movie is, like I say, the things you think that couldn't have really happened, like the scene where Zach Galifianakis is robbing the armored car.
Mm-hmm.
He knocks out three of the cameras and just doesn't notice the other one, and then does a victory dance behind the behind the van, like in this like a ridiculous victory dance, and it's all caught on tape, and it really happened.
Like they showed over the closing credits?
No, it's all in the press about it. I went and did my research after the film to see what happened, what didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much most of it happened. They sent a hitman to Mexico to kill him.
Right.
To take him out of the equation. This one, hitman's played by Jason Sudeikis.
Mm-hmm.
And in the film, he and Zach Galifianakis just become best buddies and start palling around. That also really happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about Wiggs' fellow two Ghostbusters who are in this movie?
I'm getting to them.
Oh, okay.
The premise is funny. The movie is about 45% funny.
Mm. Okay.
There aren't enough jokes because I feel as though Hess...
They thought they could just coast on the real-life wackiness?
Felt like he had a real-life absurdity that he didn't want to screw around with too much.
Right.
And he relied on his cast to do every kind of weird characterization that they could do. And you've assembled a cast that can do this in their sleep.
Sure.
Galifianakis is great at this. Kristen Wiig is great at this. Jason Sudeikis is great at this. So they just do it. And that's where the biggest humor comes from. The gestural stuff from all these folks.
Mm-hmm. The spin on a line, really.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of funny. It's got its heart in the right place in a strange way. You know, you can feel Jared Hess wanting them to get away with it. You want them to get away with it?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all so dumb, you feel sorry for them? You're like, yeah, just life is crapped all over you. Just go be rich and tacky somewhere.
Right.
And there's that moral sense of who cares? You rob a bank. Banks deserve to be robbed. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I wish it were funnier. But it's kind of sweet and kind of amusing. And I liked it with reservations, the way I liked Peregrine, with reservations.
It's the kind of movie where you didn't laugh, but you kind of went, ah.
I chuckled a lot. Leslie Jones, as the FBI agent, is not given much to do.
Hmm.
And then there's Kate McKinnon.
Yeah, there's always Kate McKinnon.
Kristen Wiig better watch out. I'm not kidding. Her career is going to be stolen right out from under her by Kate McKinnon. And it's not because Kate McKinnon is all about eving anyone or gunning for anybody. But when she comes on screen, it doesn't matter. I'm telling you the same thing that happened in Ghostbusters. When Kate McKinnon is on screen, you're looking at her.
Yeah.
Because she's doing something strange for no apparent reason. And a lot of it has to do with her eyes. She has these wild eyes. And what she's telling you with these expressions is, you don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to do. She talks about meeting her fiancé, Zach Galifianakis, at the funeral of her old boyfriend, who can't remember now how he died. But she has one of the funniest lines in the movie. I saw him and I thought, well, that one's dead. This one's alive. I'll take the live one. And then that face. I adore her so much. If I were a lesbian, I would be her stalker.
Well, I'm behind on stuff that I have to watch for What the Flick and other places, but at some point I want to watch the extended Ghostbusters that is now streaming.
What's extended about it?
Well, you know, all those, like the Paul Feig, Apatow movies, they always put out like the sort of longer, unrated version.
Mm.
I'm just curious to see what else is in there.
Right. And then we saw Deepwater Horizon.
Yes. Also a true story.
And the first of two films that we're going to get from Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg this year?
Apparently so, yeah. Apparently in December, for award season, which means most of the world will get it in 2017, right. We're getting their movie about the Boston Marathon bombing.
For Christmas?
For Christmas. Terrorism for Christmas.
Why?
Because of award season. Award season.
I'm not going. I'm not doing it.
Fine.
That movie can wait till January.
But it's already depressing.
I've got plans during December, and they don't involve crying. Unless I'm watching It's a Wonderful Life.
Right. What I don't get about all this is that for award season, why would you put two similar movies into the mix? Not that either of them necessarily has a shot at it, but like, if you're Peter Berg and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to get a director nomination...
I just think he's got juice enough to get his films released when he wants them released.
I guess, but...
This is coming out at the end of the year, and that's in my contract, you know.
But I think Deepwater Horizon maybe has been sitting around for a while. But
I don't know.
Still, you'd think you'd want to give them at least like a good six-month gap between the two. Anyway, so what we have now is Deepwater Horizon.
Explain what happens.
Deepwater Horizon, as you'll recall, the largest oil-based disaster in U.S. history.
Yes.
They dumped millions of... gallons or barrels, I forget now, into the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes.
And while I remember this story mainly...
BP, British Petroleum.
Yes.
BP did this.
So BP, and they also have... They own ARCO. So if you ever go to a BP or an ARCO station, you're giving money to the people who royally screwed the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
I remember this story as kind of the ongoing coverage of the environmental disaster, but this movie is about the explosion itself... and rescue attempts to get the people off of the oil rig. And as that story, it works pretty well. Mark Wahlberg plays like an electrical engineer. The guy running the show is Kurt Russell, you know, who everybody calls Mr. Jimmy and who's very much on top of things and trying to like keep things in order.
Good mustache.
Very good mustache. He's being outranked by the BP executives led by John Malkovich, who, because the rig is like 6 weeks behind schedule and over budget, they want to start drilling immediately, even though they've sent home the like German concrete engineers without doing a safety test, and that's going to be a problem. This movie has more about concrete safety than any film I've seen since Locke. And, you know, this does a lot right. This is one of those movies where, again, like you were saying about the kids in Peregrine, they cast a lot of interestingly faced character actors. So, like,
yeah.
Ethan Suplee and Dylan O'Brien, like people who register immediately. So later, when they're like covered in oil or wearing a hard hat, you remember who they are and how they figure into things, and, you know, you care about what happens to them. I thought the setup for all this was really good. And then once the explosions start happening and everybody's running around and trying to save themselves and to get off the thing, I thought the film got a little cacophonous and it wasn't as tight as far as like who is where? Where are they going?
Yeah.
What are their avenues of egress? You know, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So I found the last third to be a little loud and jumbled. But for the most part, I think it's well done. And the, like I said, the first two thirds are really good. And the setting up of everything that's about to happen and who it's about to happen to is pretty good. Gina Rodriguez is like, I think, the one woman on the entire thing.
Yes.
She's sort of the captain of the rig part of it. So yeah, it's, I was a little disappointed by it, but there's enough good stuff there where if this sounds like it's interesting to you and you want to know more about what went down on the Deepwater Horizon. On the day, you'll get a lot out of that. They don't deal with the aftermath at all, which kind of surprised me. I mean, on the one hand, Berg is...
Well, they talk about it.
You get the closing credits crawl and some cards about it. I mean, they don't ignore it. But, you know, Peter Berg... kind of a manly man director and kind of a conservative. I mean, he did that Lone Survivor movie, which I thought was this sort of beautiful anti-war allegory, but it turns out, no, it was about let's go kill Muslims. The right very much embraced it that way, and he didn't have a problem with it. You know, the corporate guys are the bad guys here because, you know, they aren't willing to listen to the roughnecks with the dirt under their fingernails who actually know how things work. But, you know, as Matt pointed out, you could have very just as easily also had some characters that were like, you know, fishermen or people who, you know, owned restaurants on the water.
Right.
You know, who were then SOL after all this stuff happened. But anyway, yeah, they focus on the incident itself and they do a mostly good job of that. But I think that once the incident starts happening, it gets a little...
How does this affect Quvenzhané Wallace in Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Exactly. And is she on the boat yet?
All right. Is she on the...
Is she cooking for the prostitutes on the boat
is
yet?
Is she on the catfish cooking boat yet? I think that in Lone Survivor, and in this film, you are allowed to bring yourself to the film.
Mm-hmm.
That is why Lone Survivor can be read in two ways. It can be read the way you read it, as an anti-war film, and a film about... The futility of this whole thing. A film about becoming aware of the people that you are sent to fight. You know,
and knowing that they feel about you the way you feel about them, and that all the choices are bad ones.
Yeah. Or you could go with a Lone Survivor, thinking, you know, rah rah, kill the Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and leave, thinking, yes, let's kill more of them. I believe you are allowed to bring yourself to the film, meaning that I don't believe that Peter Berg is actually keen on telling you what to think.
Hmm.
Not in Lone Survivor and not here.
Okay.
Either.
What about The Castle?
Which one was that? Did I see that?
The one with Jason Bateman about the American oil workers having to get rescued. I know I saw it. I can't remember what it's actually about. I'm sure Jason Bateman and like Jamie Foxx was in it.
Maybe. When did this come out?
Like in the late ooze? I'm pretty sure I saw it for like MSNBC.
I probably reviewed it. My review is probably up on movies.com.
I remember some of those movies that had really great like animated opening credits that explained like the history of the Middle East.
Oh, really?
Like from World War I to now.
Listen, a listener put every one of my movies.com reviews in a zip file and sent it to me.
Bless his heart.
And he's one of those tech guys who did it.
In an hour.
Like that, in an hour, yeah. And saved me countless hours of drudge work to back up and archive my own work. And I peeked into the zip file to look at some of the films.
No memory.
Once again, there are titles. I have no memory of watching these films. That hamster wheel of watch, watch, right, right, watch, right, watch, right, watch, right, talk about it, watch, right. Next week, move on. There's something new. Secure empty trash. Boom. Seriously.
Yeah.
It just all drains out of my ears in my sleep or something.
Yeah, if we remember a movie, good or bad, that means it stands out in a very crowded field.
Yeah. Anyway, what seems to interest Peter Berg is what seems to interest him most over the course of his career is propping up a traditional heroic masculinity.
Yes, for sure.
I think that that is not inherently toxic.
No.
Or at least it doesn't have to be.
Sure.
It can be about the things that he clearly thinks it's about. It can be about being good and true and honest and honorable and concerned for your community.
Yeah.
It can be those things. In practical life, it can also be feminist. It can live as an adjunct to the powerless people that you are meant to be an advocate for in life. It can be all those things in a practical way. I do not think Peter Berg has considered much of this.
He did make very bad things, after all.
That is correct. He did. But I'm talking about in an ideal state.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
Berg at his best.
I think that the thoughtless people in the world of movie watching have taken that traditional heroic masculinity and sort of turned it into the greatest goal.
Mm.
You know, a defense against feminism and a defense against perceived weakness on the part of whoever needs, you know, saving.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, for me, is the tension of a film like this and a film like Lone Survivor and the tension of the career of Peter Berg, actually. But as I'm watching this movie, I am only feeling, getting back to the film itself, I'm only feeling distress while watching this movie because I know that everything blows up and I know people die. I know that people are really going to die. Real people died, and I'm about to watch real people portrayed by actors.
So this is a nonfiction disaster movie. For
dying,
you.
Yes. This is a 70s disaster movie.
The Hindenburg.
Yeah. This is a 70s disaster movie. But it's a film about the human cost of this disaster versus the environmental cost of this disaster.
Mm-hmm.
In the media, after the fact, we heard about the environmental cost of this disaster and not much about the people who actually did the dying.
This is true.
That day.
This is true. And they deserve their moment.
The rage against BP was real and valuable and important. And the deaths of real people who were just doing their daily, day in, day out job
mm-hmm.
got kind of ignored and lost in the shuffle.
And the those closing cards do call out the fact that, like, nobody from BP got in any trouble, not just for the
right.
environmental damage,
yeah.
but for the deaths of
correct.
The people that
correct.
Were their responsibility.
So, in one way, Berg is taking a stand.
There is advocacy going on.
There is advocacy going on, and that, I was glad about that. But it's kind of a 70s disaster movie, minus the soapier elements of those films. You know, you look at a film like Airport or The Poseidon Adventure
right.
or The Towering Inferno, especially The Towering Inferno.
Right. Well, I mentioned The Hindenburg because it's a non because
and
it's
the,
a real
and
thing.
Even The Hindenburg, there's an element of the soap opera in all of those
sure.
Films, and then the disaster happens, and then everybody has to sort of become their better selves,
right? Or not, and then fall down a stair.
But one way it is like a 70s disaster movie is that if you look at movie, particularly The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno and Earthquake. The beginning of the film is someone warning somebody. Mm. Someone saying, don't do this. Something bad's going to happen. Don't do this. Something bad's going to happen. Fix this.
Oh,
something bad's going to happen.
Pish and tosh.
Yeah. And you have someone along, a greedy person,
right.
getting in the way and saying, nope, we're doing it the way that's going to save and make us money.
Yeah.
And that's what happens here. This first 30 minutes of the film is everybody yelling at the BP guys. Mark Wahlberg has this great moment where he's like, would you like a specific list of the things that need fixing on this rig? I will tell it to you right now. And then he rattles it off.
I like the speech he has later about how luck is not a strategy.
Yeah. 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 Hope
is not a strategy.
Hope is not a strategy.
No, you're right, and I think maybe, you know, because the disaster movies in toto are seen in retrospect as kind of an American response to Vietnam and Watergate and a lack of faith in our institutions.
Yes,
I guess we could put this in that category. In our corporate institutions, certainly, you know.
Yes.
Even though our corporate institutions are also funding and distributing these films, you know.
Yes. So it's not a bad movie.
It's not bad. No. I wish it could have been. There were things about it that could have been better, but it's not bad.
But I felt a lot of anxiety watching it because it just felt like, oh God, more dying and more exploding and more dying and more exploding and yeah.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't see Command and Control.
Remind me what that is.
I didn't see it either. It's a documentary that opened this week about this incident in 1980.
Oh, that's this week. It's a new movie this week. Command and Control.
Yeah.
A documentary. Mm-hmm. All right. Is it playing in Los Angeles?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
It's about the Damascus incident. Apparently, there was literally a guy dropped a wrench in a missile silo in 1980 and almost started World War III.
Oh, man.
And our nuclear arsenal is aging and not as secure or, you know...
Okay, great.
...as it should be.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Where's it playing?
I don't know, but it is out there. I assigned a review. Sam Adams wrote about it for The Wrap. Remember Maddow did that whole thing about how they're still... How the missile silos still use the 12-inch floppy disks?
Well, that's right.
Like the really old computer.
Yeah, that's right.
It's never been updated.
Are you going to start watching Rachel Maddow again?
Maybe. Maybe after the election. Maybe I'll simmer down.
I know you got all mad at her and took her out of the queue.
She let me down. She knows what she did.
I kind of miss her, though.
Well, at some point, I've occasionally been thinking about relenting.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. This is actually a discussion for LKTV.
You're right, yes.
But this is what we're going to do. November 5th.
Okay.
Okay.
Deal.
It is the 4th, right? The election is the 4th?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that, but I think it is Tuesday the 4th.
Something like that.
Do we have a calendar?
Hang on. Halloween is a Monday, so November 1st is a Tuesday. It's November 8th. I want to say
the election is the first or second week of November.
It's, I think
it's November 8th because that's it's the yellow is on my
yeah,
eight. Yeah, November 8th. So, November 9th,
Maddow,
we start watching Rachel Maddow again.
Fair enough,
no matter what happens.
Okay, is that everything? Is that the week?
Yeah, I got
all right.
Some.
Hang on, you did your DVD pick, which was The Howling.
Mm-hmm.
My DVD pick is a perfectly suitable for October movie if you're in a Halloween mood, or just if you are missing the good Tim Burton, Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
A movie that totally holds up and
yeah.
I think taps into what he does best in terms of his mix of animation and live action, his love of kitsch and of old monster tropes and of old movies in general. Yeah, it's lovely and it holds up.
Letters. This is from Reed.
Okay.
Reed Martin.
Mm.
The author of
The Real Truth.
Yeah.
Everything you didn't know you need to know about making an independent film.
Which is, we're not doing an ad.
No, we're just saying it, because that's how we talk.
We used to do ads for him.
Yes. That was a freebie, Reed. You're welcome.
Hi, Alonzo. I guess this was in response to, or maybe this is, can you pause it for a moment?
Sure.
The subject line is other possible theory, but I don't know what the first part of this conversation was.
Well,
and it may have been something that we were talking about on the show.
Probably.
The letter is from all the way back at the end of August.
All right, so. Well, read it and let's see if we can kill it.
Hi, Alonzo. Another possible theory is that evangelical films today, so I guess this was a response to us talking about some evangelical film.
Yes.
They really only click when they serve a purpose or fill an existing gap in the cinematic liturgy.
Maybe were we talking about like Miracles from Heaven or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Here he goes. So a film that shows how hope and miracles come to those who believe can succeed financially, such as Miracles from Heaven, while a cynical Gladiator knockoff with only a cameo for Jesus doesn't move people to show up opening weekend.
We were talking about why the evangelicals didn't go see Ben-Hur.
Okay. However, a film that delivered a very tough R-rated rendering of the crucifixion, The Passion, will bring people out because they want to see if it's as rough as they imagine it might be. But the more recent films don't fill a need because they're not visualizing anything people feel they just have to see or need to see or need others to see to really get it. Wow, now I get it. Noah? No, there's no need for anyone to see that story. So that's just one theory why audiences of faith will stay home in droves for something like Ben-Hur. It's not an allegory for anything. It's just a period film with bad effects. And the other, random, faith audience courting movies like Last Days in the Desert just don't offer a new puzzle piece or provide any kind of wow factor with new visuals that would contribute to a Sunday sermon that folks haven't already seen.
No, that's probably true. And I think the God's Not Dead movies do provide that sense of, like, sticking it to the man, you know.
Yes, they do. Although the second one didn't make anything near the amount of money that the first one did.
Interesting.
This is from Aaron. Hello, gentlemen. I'm one of your Patreon subscribers.
Yay.
Not only because your podcasts are always rewarding, not only because you have become friends in my head, you are to me what the Shaws or perhaps the Tiny Twins are to Dave White. I pay out a smidgen of hard-earned money to you because listening to you has made me a better husband.
Whoa!
Oh.
Please continue. I wonder where this is going.
Okay, it's like Charles Barkley said, I'm not a role model. All right, here he says. And then he goes on, really? At least once a week during a troublesome discussion with the wife I love, I'll ask myself, how might Dave and or Alonzo respond to this provocation?
Oh, man. I hope you're still married.
Have I just ruined the
it's fine.
The volume?
It's,
Did I laugh too loudly into the microphone?
No, it's fine.
I apologize if I did. I tried to hold my face away from it. Believe it or not, this tends to work out really well. Our marriage is a little bit stronger because of your example. Take care. I don't know how.
Obviously, we need to start doing a Yakov Smirnoff style speaking engagement.
Marriage. How to be married.
Marriage. What a country.
I have no idea what he's talking about. I mean, okay. Thank you, Aaron. I know it's got to be true. You told me it was true. It's really happening.
I'm sure he means all the times that you say something really stupid, and then I'm like very patient and explain to you.
And how do I deal with that
provocation? In all the ways that you're wrong.
When you are telling me I'm
and
stupid and
so
wrong,
my,
how I deal with that provocation is how he's being
of
helping.
Correcting you.
I'm helping him by dealing with your provocations.
I'm giving him the example of what to do when faced with
utter bollocks. I'm a picture
of
calm
fixing everything
and reason.
Because you're the bad example. You're the goofus of the marriage. You're the marriage goofus. And I am marriage gallant.
I'm the man that roasts that chicken. Which, by the way, happens in 90 minutes.
Ooh,
only if you're good.
And it's been drying.
Only if
fridge.
Did you hear the part? The most important part?
Yes.
Only if you're good.
I'm always good.
Because you know what happens if I roast that chicken and I don't think you've been good?
Salmonella.
Just for your part.
Mine comes out early.
No, here's what's gonna happen. I'm just gonna eat that all of it.
The damn you am.
And you won't get any.
That's not.
Think about that. Think about that next time you deliver some provocations.
Yeah, you're already, you're being marriage goofus, and I'm trying to teach Aaron and others how to be a good spouse.
Christopher Robles has sent us two letters in two different PDFs. I'm going to have to download those and then.
You can just click on it, and it'll open on your screen.
All right.
other Christopher Robles, by the way, has been really fronting.
Yeah, I don't know which Christopher Robles this is.
This is the other Christopher Robles.
We have two people named Chris Robles. Listening to this show is a weird coincidence.
Donuts Christopher Robles has been representing with his Linoleum Knife Finery on Instagram with the shirt and the tote bag, and it's been great. This is the other Christopher Robles who we have not had donuts with, who also writes us and listens to the show.
This says letter number two. So there was a letter number one that I haven't found yet.
No, well, maybe letter number one is the one that we already read on the show.
Maybe.
That's what he's
referring to. All right, well, here it is. Chris R. of Bloomington, California.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dave and Alonzo, it's Chris R. again. If you guys forgot, I was the one who gave a top 10. If you guys forgot, we know you. If you guys forgot, I was the one who gave a top 10 list of favorite filmmakers. By the way, when I listed my honorable mentions, there were some names I forgot, like Richard Linklater, the Coen brothers, Agnes Varda, Ozu, Stan Brakhage, Hollis Frampton, Robert Altman, Sean Baker. You should know my full name is Chris Robles. But since hearing that you guys have donut friend also named Chris Robles, see, no, this is the other one.
That's what I said. I said other Chris Robles who we had donuts with has been representing on Instagram.
Oh,
and
this is other
Chris Robles.
But he also lives in California.
I know.
Okay, I've got it.
Don't we just call him Chris R. like in The Room?
All right. Okay. From now on, you're Chris R.
Yes.
Because you came second.
Yes.
And because we know donut Chris Robles in person.
Right. Yes.
If you come to Los Angeles, we can take you to the same donut place and just confuse ourselves.
And really baffle everybody.
Confuse ourselves more. Yeah. Okay. Since hearing that you guys have a donut friend also named Chris Robles, I shortened my name to avoid confusion. Also, I love donuts. And if I'm ever in the neighborhood, I would love to buy you guys some free donuts. Except
it's a date.
Where's Bloomington? How soon can you get here? My favorite part of the podcast is you guys talking about your strange theater experiences. My favorite one being Dave's experience watching Super Babies. My weirdest moment, for anyone in the dark, I had to review Super Babies, Baby Geniuses 2, at the old Beverly Center, the jankiest theater that ever was in Los Angeles.
It was not screened for the press.
And I went, and it was me and like six mommies with little kids.
On a Friday morning.
On a Friday morning, and all of them were like looking at me like,
stranger danger.
Get away. Creepy. Creepy bro. Yeah.
50 feet.
My weirdest moment was when my grandmother and I went to see the first Hangover movie. I always went to the movies with my grandmother. Because every weekend, I always went to her house, and going to the movies was one of the ways to spend quality time together. She always let me pick the movie, and I mean any movie. I took her to see Jackass 3, by the way, which she loved. If there was any person who made me fall in love with movies and made me want to go into a career in movies, it was her. Anyway, we went to see The Hangover the first day it opened. We went to the Regency Rialto 8 Theater in Rialto. That theater is now a Walmart neighborhood market. But they used the same building, which means it still looks like a movie theater. Anyway, sorry for going off topic. We went to see The Hangover in a fairly crowded theater. Most of them looked like they were in their 20s, but there was this old guy who looked like he was in his 60s sitting in the back row. He looked like a drifter. When we got to the scene in the movie where they finally find their missing friend on the roof with terrible sunburn, this old guy yells out, "He looks like a Mexican." Everyone in the theater, including myself, turned their head around to the guy with a, "What the hell did he just say?" He didn't say anything else after that. It was a weird moment. I've had other weird moments, including when I was watching the movie Hancock with the theater lights still on and no one doing anything about it. Or the two old ladies who were loudly laughing during The Love Guru. They were laughing so loudly that an usher came up to tell them that they were laughing too loudly. It was the only funny moment in what was a dreadful experience. That movie was ish. Anyway, love you guys. Chris R. of Bloomington, P.S. I read on Alonzo's Wikipedia page that it said back in January 2010 he was a contestant on Jeopardy. Is this true? And if true, how well did he do?
It is true.
You have told the story before, but tell it again in the miniature version.
I came in second.
Yep.
The woman next to me...
You lost on Jeopardy.
Baby. The woman next to me was unbeatable on that button, only because she was nervous, because then on her second game when she was returning champion, she got stomped. But she beat me, and but for second place, you still get $2,000. So
yep, you came home with $2,000.
Can't come before taxes.
So I roasted you another chicken that day.
That was nice, and as they say, it's an honor just to be nominated. Just getting on to Jeopardy is an exciting thing in and of itself.
P.P.S. Dave, you had a Wikipedia page too, but it's gone. Know any reasons why?
Nope. What? Really? Yours is gone?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Good.
I mean, neither of us created our own.
I need to be found.
They appeared one day.
I don't need to be founded by anyone.
I'm pretty easily found.
Yeah. Somebody wrote a really sort of skeletal, bare bones kind of Wikipedia page for me. And if I remember correctly, it said something like, he is known as the king of pancakes.
Well, you are.
Well, you know.
The world needs to know these important facts about you.
I don't think he is known as the king of pancakes is enough to sustain a Wikipedia page.
Evidently not.
Apparently, someone took issue with the factual nature of the king of pancakes claim.
Perhaps the
and had it taken
the
down.
The true king of pancakes. Had his viscount right. Send over a complaint.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Anyway, that's the end.
All right. Well,
of the show. Why don't you join our club?
Won't you?
Here's what you should do. You go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/linoleumknife. Spell it right. And you'll come to our page, and there's a video that explains how to join our club and all the beautiful things that will happen to you when you do that. When you do it, your life is going to get so much better. It costs you $4 a month.
And if you want some idea of what you'll get for your $4 a month...
It could also cost you more than $4 a month, but sure. the minimum is a $4 a month thing.
And that gets you LKTV. And
the podcast of the television.
And if you want to know what LKTV is like, we have a free episode on our Patreon page waiting for you.
Yeah, you can just go to Patreon right now and listen to it.
It's
decide if it's worth your
it's
dollar.
It's this week's episode. Dave and I are working
our way...
Your weekly
dollar.
We are working our way through the fall TV schedule, so we watched pilots for shows like This Is Us and Son of Zorn and Kevin Can Wait and talk all about them on the show. And we've been doing weekly updates on the very important programs like Finding Prince Charming and Dancing with the Stars. And you get to hear about our fantasy Dancing with the Stars team and vote on our first week's dance-off between Olivia de Havilland and Steve Kornacki. There's so much waiting for you. There's really no contest. We'll see how it goes. There's all sorts of things waiting for you at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Go to bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA.com for more information about all of his amazing stuff. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and Canceled Too Soon, both featuring Bibbs and Whitney. Check out the Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, the Joel Ryan Thing, the Sewers of Paris, the Comics Canon, Film Spotting SVU, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram at LinoleumCast. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, and please leave us a review there. It really does help. And you can also leave us feedback on all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, and Satchel. And if you have an Android, Google Play. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your questions and comments. We are a little backlogged on mail, but we're going to be doing an all letters episode.
That's right.
To get caught up. And those always have other fun things in it. So, even if you haven't written us a letter, if you like the show, you'll like that special as well. Next week we'll talk about American Honey. And
next week we're going to start talking about how you can get a very special edition of Alonzo Duralde's book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
Oh, yes. And some other cool...
It ain't too early.
No.
Some people like to get their stuff done.
Start that shopping.
In advance.
And we'll have some other cool retail possibilities for you as well in the coming weeks.
Yes.
So stick around for that. And until next time.
Is there anything else we have to tell?
I can't think of anything. Oh, if you're in Los Angeles, this Wednesday, October 5th, at the West Hollywood Public Library, we're screening Kurt McDowell's infamous Thundercrack, written by one or both of the Kuchar brothers. It's a sexy and outrageous underground parody of old Dark House movies, getting the Halloween spirit rolling early. No one under 18 allowed. It's a beautiful new high-def transfer, and it should be fun. Come check it out.
Okay, goodbye.